Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very excited to be reconnecting this morning with two friends from the Racine Symphony Orchestra, Beth Bender, the executive director, and Pasquale Laurino, who is artistic director and conductor. He has held that post since 2011. And of course, for the Racine Symphony Orchestra and for performing arts organizations everywhere, life is anything but normal right now, but it is inspiring to see how various organizations are finding ways to be active and vital and reaching out to their constituencies and audiences. And the Racine Symphony Orchestra has a very exciting project underway. They're in the midst of it, and sort of the next chapter of it is to be released to the public tomorrow night, Saturday night at 7:30 p.m., namely the next in the continuing cycle of the Four Seasons of Antonio Vivaldi, with Maestro Laurino as the violin soloist as well as conductor. So we're going to be talking for the next few minutes about this project and what it has been like to put it together. So we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Great to be here.
Glad to have you here. So, Beth Bender, let's begin with you. Just give us some sense of what it is like for a performing arts organization like the Racine Symphony to be contending with as severe a reversal as this current COVID-19 pandemic. What have you and the board of directors and your artistic director, in a sense, been sort of talking about in terms of how to weather this?
It's been very strange, and I don't think anybody could have ever predicted an environment where we were not able to give live performances at all. A lot of our discussions have been around how we serve our community, because the Racine part of the Racine Symphony is integral. I mean, we're not the New York Phil, we're not some of these bigger orchestras that draw from a worldwide fan base. We serve Racine, the Racine area, and our beloved patrons are in that area. And so how do we continue to serve the community when we can't gather in person?
So tell us about the advent of this particular project involving Antonio Vivaldi's Four Seasons. What were some of the first conversations around this possibility?
Well, we talked about pivoting to some sort of recorded content, and you know, we're throwing around a couple of ideas, and Pasquale did give me a list of repertoire to look into. And then I started thinking about the Four Seasons in terms of the longevity of we've essentially have a year's worth of material. We're getting our audience through this, because even if we were able to just immediately right now start holding live events, I think there's still a large portion of our audience who are not going to be comfortable attending a live concert for quite some time. So we wanted to be able to serve them. And then, you know, the violin is such an integral part of the piece, The Four Seasons. And what greater way to highlight our fabulous resource of Pasquale by highlighting him both as an artistic director and as the wonderful violinist that he is.
So the decision was made to create some performances of The Four Seasons, which is four violin concertos in one, taking us through the seasons, and we'll talk with the maestro in a moment a little more about the work itself. Beth, tell us a little bit about kind of the logistics that would make a performance like this possible and safe.
Well, we can do it. Well, first of all, only string players, which, no offense to our wind and brass and vocal colleagues, I think the jury is really still out as to the safety of being in a room with somebody playing a wind or brass instrument or singing. And once again, we recorded this in June. So the planning of this was happening in April and in May. So there was even less known at that time. The Four Seasons can be done with a very small ensemble. I believe it was a 10-person orchestra plus Pasquale. And that's actually very easy to find a location that you can socially distance in. We recorded this at First Presbyterian Church in Racine, and I actually went there several weeks before the recording and like took some pictures and then put some papers on the floor to try to figure out how can we do this safely. And First Pres is an amazing facility. The staff there is wonderful. They're always very welcoming. And with that large of a space, with only 10 people on stage, it was quite easy to socially distance them in a way that we wouldn't have been able to do in a smaller space or with a larger ensemble.
Pasquale Lorino, let's find out from you a little bit about, first of all, the logistics of creating these performances in this, in a sense, unconventional format, physical formation. Tell us a little bit about what that was like, and in particular, the very first rehearsal with your members of the orchestra physically distanced from one another. What was that like?
Certainly, the whole cue system is very much different. The spatial aspect. Normally, you would be sitting abreast of someone in very, very close proximity, having also the advantage of visual clues, not only being what you do with your instrument, but also what your face is able to convey. We were masked during the recordings, and this created a special challenge to be able to communicate what you wanted from the musicians with somewhat limited facial expression. The eyes can tell a lot, and obviously the music itself is a wordless medium that allows a great deal of communication to occur, even though words can't be spoken. So we found, you know, when you lose one sense, it heightens another. We found new ways to communicate, perhaps on a more highly honed level.
Did you find that musicians had any reluctance to come together, even knowing that they would be physically distanced and with every precaution possible taken? Was there still any hesitancy, or were your musicians by and large so anxious and eager to do this that any misgivings they might have had were quickly shunted to the side?
I think certainly the latter. By and large, we had a great deal of enthusiasm. People were clearly very emotional about just being able to physically be together in the same space and communicate musically. And the residuals of that experience led us to know that we have to find a way to continue to do this, to continue to hone our skills in a way that that keeps us together.
Had any consideration been given to what I'm sure you're well aware of, as probably a lot of our listeners are, of truly virtual performances in which musicians are not actually in the same room, but each in the safety of their own apartment or wherever, creating their own part, and then somebody at the end does all of the electronic wizardry to combine all of those individual parts into one, which of course is something very, very different, but it's also something that some organizations are doing. Was any serious consideration given to that, or did it make much more sense as far as you were concerned to come together in a room a little closer to what your experiences has been before?
Yes, I find these independent piecemeal performances to be very contrived. There is very little that's relatable with what the actual experience of making music is. Oftentimes you're performing to a pre-existing track, or sometimes even a click track, as you would be in a recording studio, without the benefit of anyone else in the room. It is, not to overstate it, but it seems to me a bit anti-art, and certainly this was a preferred method if we had a way to make it work by being able to be responsibly distanced from each other, but yet to experience the music simultaneously in the same room, seemed to be the only way that would be satisfactory for me artistically. Mm-hmm.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Pasquale Laurino, who is artistic director and conductor of the Racine Symphony, and also with us, Beth Bender, executive director of the Racine Symphony. We're talking right now about a project that the Racine Symphony undertook to record the four violin concertos that comprise the four seasons of Antonio Vivaldi, one of the great masterworks of the Baroque era. And earlier, their recording of the Summer Concerto was shared, and this Saturday night, tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m., their recording of the Autumn Concerto will be shared with the public for the first time. Pasquale Laurino, tell us, our listeners, a little more about the genesis of this work by Vivaldi and what makes it so special and distinctive from many other concertos written at the same time. What sets the Four Seasons apart?
Well, the Four Seasons are part of an opus that were published as bold experiments in harmony and invention. They make up his opus 8. The first four concertos make up the Four Seasons, and with the concertos, he had accompanying sonnets about each of the seasons. These were ways that he was able to reference very specifically the narrative that the sonnets suggest. And certainly it was among the very first works that were program music, descriptive music. We hear thunderstorms, we hear wind, we hear dogs barking, we hear horns blaring, we hear lots of the sounds that make up the year and the elements of nature. It's an extraordinary work that really bears no resemblance to a typical concerto. There's no rondo form or ABA form that you can identify. It is inextricably linked to this set of sonnets that were written, and they were really, really quite revolutionary. Mm.
Tell us how much rehearsal took place before the record button was actually hit for the Vivaldi. I mean, and have all four concertos already been performed and recorded?
Well, because of the extraordinary circumstances and extremely limited amount of time that we had to be together, we felt that the most prudent thing to do would be to rehearse and videotape each of the movements of the concerto and each of the concertos over a two-day period, which was a very truncated rehearsal time. In addition, we had our young artist soloists appearing on the same day in some quartet performances for educational purposes. So it was a very, very full rehearsal and performance period, rather than really have the luxury of going back fitting in, splicing. We perform the movements completely through, determining whether it was a valid take or not, and then moved on to the next movement. This very, very truncated rehearsal period was very much to the credit of the members of the Racine Symphony to be able to pull this thing together without having the benefit of a conductor standing in front of them. I was busy with the solo part and tried to give as many cues as possible just through way by way of body language, which again was limited by the mass. So there were lots of arms behind my back during the project. But given the fact that obviously the pieces are very familiar, but everyone's approach is different, it was largely to the credit of the membership involved that we were able to get through all of this material in a couple of days. Mm.
It's nice too that these performances took place in First Presbyterian Church, which is one of the spaces where, of course, the community has come to know and love the Racine Symphony. Many of many important musical performances occur there, including some performances that have involved the Racine Symphony. So I'm sure that it felt good to be there.
Indeed.
So Beth Bender, explain how people who are interested in hearing this music making can do so.
Well, we will have a link on our Facebook page, and you can also just go to YouTube. I believe it's YouTube.com/users/Racine Symphony. I will be honest, 9 times out of 10, I just go to YouTube and type Racine Symphony, and we will pop right up.
Very good. So is the Sunday performance, I'm trying to remember, of the summer concerto, is that still available for people to enjoy if they missed it?
Yes, that is going to be available forever and always now. And I would also encourage people, Pasquale briefly mentioned that we had an education performance that same day that we recorded, but also our very darling 2020 Young Artist Competition winner. She was supposed to perform with the orchestra Mozart Concerto on the April concert, and we obviously had to cancel that concert, so we were able to give that opportunity. And we've got that recording up on our YouTube page too, and she's fabulous. So I was really happy not only to give the musicians a chance to perform live music, but also to give her a chance to play with professionals.
Fantastic. And I know that you are appreciative of people who are continuing to support the Racine Symphony through this time. Just can you say a quick word about how people can do that if they want to be of help to the cause one way or another?
Oh, yes. We always love donations, and our patrons have been extraordinarily kind to us during this time, and we have no reason to believe that won't continue. They can head to racinesymphony.org, and there's a big old donate button right on there.
Very good. Maestro Pasquale Rino, any last word from you for our listeners?
Well, I do have to say, during this extraordinary time, to take an opportunity to congratulate you, Greg, on the incredible work that you're doing to continue to be an advocate for the arts, and personally presenting these songs every day. They were very much a solace during the early days of this COVID, to be able to enter your living space and to enjoy the work of you and your wife through this period. I really was very moved by the expression, and I thank you for that.
Well, music matters to all of us right now, even though in some ways we can't experience it or perform it in the customary ways that we did before. So I applaud this wonderful idea of sharing this masterpiece by Antonio Vivaldi with the public. And we remind everybody again that the autumn concerto from Vivaldi's Four Seasons will be shared this Saturday evening at 7:30 and available forever after, with Pasquale Larino as the violinist and conductor of musicians from the Racine Symphony. Pasquale Larino and Beth Bender, I appreciate both of you joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's enjoy a brief portion now from the Autumn Concerto of Antonio Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, his Opus 8. Each of these four violin concerti is paired with a sonnet. And there is some speculation that Vivaldi himself perhaps wrote these sonnets, which vividly describe each of the seasons. And Vivaldi's music carefully parallels what is mentioned in these texts. In fact, in Vivaldi's original score, there are even places in the score where he makes indication with letter of how a portion of the sonnet paired with that is being depicted at that moment in the score. It's really one of the first examples of first-rate program music, in which music is composed to vividly paint a picture or tell a story. On this American Gramophone recording of the complete Four Seasons, we hear the group Musica Anima, with Arnie Roth as violinist and conductor, and actor Patrick Stewart reading an English translation of these sonnets. Here is the beginning of the Autumn Sonnet and the music which follows it.
Autumn. The peasants celebrate with song and dance the joy of gathering a bountiful harvest, and with generous draughts of Bacchus' cup, their joy finishes in slumber.
Beautiful music of Antonio Vivaldi. And again, we remind you to go to the Racine Symphony's website, racinesymphony.org, for more information about their ongoing project with Vivaldi's Four Seasons and the sharing of their recording of the Autumn Concerto, Saturday evening, 7:30. You are listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's morning show is from the archives, an interview recorded and first broadcast back in 2015. I always enjoy the opportunity to come to understand the meaning of words more thoroughly and more completely. And that is one of the pleasures in reading a new book called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World, a book which helps us understand in much more comprehensive fashion what is meant by terms like imagination, creativity, innovation. Those are terms which many of us, most of us probably, use pretty much interchangeably. But they each play a really important role, a crucial role, in successful entrepreneurship in this modern world in which we all live and try to function and succeed. And the author of this book, Insight Out, is Dr. Tina Selig. She earned a PhD in neuroscience from Stanford University Medical School and is now professor of the practice in the Department of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford School of Engineering, and also executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. So for many years now, she has been working with young people to help them understand and then harness their own creative ideas and entrepreneurial ventures. She is responsible for a previous bestseller called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and another book called Ingenious, A Crash Course on Creativity. And this newest book is published by HarperCollins. Again, it is called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. And Professor Tina Selig, we welcome you to the morning show.
Wow, that was such a fabulous introduction. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. And this is a great book. I have really enjoyed exploring it on a couple of different levels. I wonder if we could start with the rather personal note on which the book begins, with the story you relate of
coming across a letter which you yourself had, in effect, written to yourself 30 years earlier.
Yeah, it was quite an amazing story. I mean, really, somebody couldn't have made this up. I wrote this book called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and soon after it came out, I got an email from an old friend I hadn't seen since I was a teenager, and he said, gosh, you know, is this the same Tina Seeley? We went to camp together when we were kids. And so I thought, wow, of course, and I knew that he had sent me a bunch of letters in those days when we actually wrote letters, you know, on paper. So I went through a big box of letters my parents had sent to me when they moved, and I found the letters he wrote, but more interesting, I stumbled upon one letter I had written to myself on the eve of my 20th birthday. Now, you realize I'd written this book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and all of a sudden this letter from 30 years earlier on the eve of my 20th birthday pops into my hand. And the letter basically said, I'm completely lost. I don't know what I'm doing. I have such huge dreams for myself. I have no idea how to get from where I am now to where I want to be. And I could feel that every day now teaching at Stanford, the same thing in my students. The idea that they have such incredible aspirations, and I felt like it was my responsibility to think about how do you actually get your ideas out of your head and into the world? How do you go through that process? And even after years teaching this topic, I realized that there were a lot of miscommunications and wanted to put a stake in the ground that was going to help other people make their dreams come true and sort of live the lives that they dream to live.
I really appreciated something that you said about the way in which at least much of formal education tends to fail its students. And I'm applauding that as someone who happens to teach at a college as my full-time job. So I'm in the trenches with you, but I see this happen, and I've certainly been guilty of it myself. You say at one point, unfortunately, most formal education deals with memorization as opposed to innovation. It focuses on learning about heroes as opposed to teaching students to be heroic. And it presents problems with one right answer as opposed to real-life challenges with an endless number of viable solutions. Here's my favorite line. People should emerge from school with agency, feeling empowered to address the opportunities and challenges that await them. I guess what you're saying is you came to realize in a clearer way your responsibility as a college professor to offer that up to your students.
Exactly. Well, you know, we live in a very different world than our education was designed for, right? It was designed before there was books and the internet, and, you know, people had to get up and lecture to transmit information. But information is a commodity now. We can all find out this information. And the world is changing so fast. It really is our responsibility to teach people, A, how to learn, and how to tap into their passions so that they can solve the problems that they really want to solve. The world is filled with lots of challenges, and we really need to prepare people to address them, you know, whether they're the individual challenges in their own life to the challenges that, you know, face the planet.
Hmm. Before we start talking about your book a little more specifically, I wonder if you could say a word about this thing called the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. I suspect that the whole reason for its existence folds nicely into what we are going to be talking about today.
Great. Yeah. So I'm fortunate enough to be the executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. This is a program I helped build over the last 16 years. And essentially, our philosophy is this. We're in the School of Engineering at Stanford. And the philosophy is that it's no longer good enough for students to come out of school with a purely technical training. They need to understand the entrepreneurial world in which they're going to be working, whether they're individual contributors, running a team, leading an organization, or even starting a company. They need to know how to put together effective teams. They need to know how to lead. They need to know how to negotiate. They need to know how to be creative problem solvers. In fact, to be honest, we say that teaching entrepreneurship is a Trojan horse for teaching very, very important life skills. These skills are important no matter what you do, and you can be entrepreneurial in everything you do.
I guess that's a really great place for us to start, because actually I think that is really crucial to us even being able to take in a lot of the ideas that you share here, because I think the idea of being an entrepreneur or entrepreneurship or entrepreneurial skills, that's a term that we tend to think of fairly restrictively. And I, for one, have never used that term in describing anything that I do in my very busy, complex life. And in fact, in the way that you're using this term, it's a term we should not be scared of, and we should readily apply to ourselves, even if we've never done that before. Explain how we can open up this our sense of what it means to be entrepreneurial and why we should do that.
Oh, thank you so much for asking that. If you came to our offices at Stanford, painted on the wall in very big letters, it says, entrepreneurs do much more than imaginable with much less than seems possible. And that is the core of what it means to be entrepreneurial. It means seizing opportunities, leveraging resources, making things happen. I am sure you do that every single day in your life. And if you understand that you're an entrepreneur, it gives you that mindset that really you are a problem solver. It's interesting. We had a brand new dean, and she's fabulous, who just started in the School of Engineering, and she's a physicist, quite talented. And at first she came in and was sort of allergic to the term entrepreneurship. I mean, she was very, very actively saying, I don't like this word. And she went and talked with every single faculty member in the School of Engineering at Stanford. That's hundreds of people. And she, at the end, said, I've changed my mind. I understand now that entrepreneurship is about problem solving, and that that's what we do here. And that is core to the philosophy and the approach that we have here. And so it's something that is super important for everyone to embrace, from young kids to anyone, you know, of any age, that they too can address the challenges around them and come up with really, really creative solutions.
I appreciate how you take this apart in the first chapter of the book, saying that there are three elements to the entrepreneurial mind, that you need to see the world as opportunity-rich, you need to have a specific set of tools for solving problems, and each of those was addressed in earlier books. And this book really points to that third element, which is crucial to successful entrepreneurship, moving from inspiration to implementation.
Yeah, so I didn't realize until I got to the end that this book was the third part of the trilogy. Now, the book's going to certainly be read in any order. They're not designed to be read 1, 2, 3. But what I wish I knew when I was 20 is really about having an entrepreneurial mindset, about seeing the world as opportunity-rich. Ingenious is really, you get to walk right into my classroom, and it's all about the tools I teach about creativity and innovation. That book's called Ingenious. And this book really weaves them both together and shows the relationship between your attitudes and your actions. And essentially, I walk people through this invention cycle, going from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship, showing the attitudes and actions that have to happen along the way to really bring your ideas to life.
As you are introducing us to this concept, one of the things you do is help us understand the background behind the phrase thinking outside the box, which a lot of us use rather carelessly. And it's so interesting to know exactly the origins of this phrase. Share that with our listeners.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I personally am not a fan of that phrase. And in fact, most of the people I know who teach creativity aren't either. Because it's used as a catch-all. It's used as a cliche. You know, if I ask people, hey, what does creativity mean to you? They go, well, thinking outside the box. I said, well, what does that mean? And it turns out that term comes from the old puzzle that you might be familiar with, where you have nine dots, you know, rows of three dots, and your goal is to create, to connect all the dots using lines, four or fewer lines, without taking the pen off the paper. And the only way to actually do that is to draw beyond the frame, the invisible frame of that box, to allow the lines to connect. And that's where the term thinking outside the box comes from. Now, most people don't know that, and so when they even say it, they don't even know what that means. So I really challenge people to think much more systematically about what it means to be creative and what tools you actually need to make that happen.
Right after you explain the origins of the phrase, you use another phrase which I find really intriguing. And it's really the point of your whole book, but I sort of love the way these words kind of frame this in a way that is kind of maybe surprising to us. You're saying, in reality, creativity requires a complex set of skills, attitudes, and actions. I mean, much more important than thinking outside the box would suggest. Intimately related to imagination, innovation, and entrepreneurship. Here's the part I love. To harness our creativity, we need a robust set of definitions for all parts of the creative and entrepreneurial process.
Right.
But I think that's so intriguing. I think most of us, when we think about creativity, think of it as something that by its very nature needs to be unleashed and not harnessed or limited in any way. And of course, in a sense, that kind of creativity is so aimless that it ends up maybe accomplishing nothing or very little. And this notion of harnessing creativity for a productive end, that's really valuable, and probably especially valuable for people that we immediately and most obviously think of as being creative.
But think about it. We harness our physical abilities when we become an athlete, or our artistic abilities when we become, you know, a painter, or our musical abilities. You know, we have all of these innate abilities, and yet if they're not used and harnessed, we don't have a coach, we don't have someone who's going to help us really use our muscles the right way and to look at things in a very thoughtful way as an artist, we end up being very sloppy. And the same thing is true with creativity. With a framework, with a set of tools, you can really focus your abilities and make yourself stronger. I mean, just as if I exercise, I make my muscles stronger. If I use my creativity in a very thoughtful way, I get stronger at that as well.
Absolutely. And towards that end, this book then really helps us sort of understand this whole process.
Exactly. That's the hope.
Right. So you craft something which you call at one point a scaffolding of skills, which is important here. And it helps us distinguish between terms which you yourself say you've often used indiscriminately. As though they're pretty much the same thing. And the longer you have explored this, the more you realize that these terms are each distinct from the other. The terms are imagination leads to creativity, creativity to innovation, innovation to entrepreneurship. But we need to make sure we're really clear about imagination, creativity, innovation, and how they are each their own unique step in this process.
Yeah, and this is really important. And you bring up the fact that I do admit that for years I used the words interchangeably. You know, people conflate the words imagination and creativity. You know, they use them interchangeably, or creativity and innovation. But I realized that's a huge missed opportunity. So the framework that I create is very simple, and I wanted it to be simple so that it's easy to remember and then easy to harness. So the idea is that imagination is envisioning things that don't yet exist. Pretty simple, right? It's something we do all the time. Okay? Creativity is applying our imagination to address a challenge. But we might be coming up with a solution that's been invented before. That's fine. It's new to me. It might not be new to the world. Innovation, though, is applying that creativity to come up with really unique solutions, things that are unique to the world. And entrepreneurship is applying your innovation to bring the invention of whatever sort to the rest of the world. Now, at each step along the way, there's a set of actions and attitudes that are required to get you to the next step. I liken this to the process of learning to talk, right? We start out with sounds we make. We apply those sounds to make words, apply those words to make sentences, and those sentences to make stories. And that same sort of hierarchy applies when going from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship.
Hmm. I think as I glanced at your book the first time, the part that was maybe the most surprising to me was trying to take apart something like imagination. Because I think most of us, when we think about imagination and being imaginative, we think of that as something that, you know, maybe we have it or we don't. I mean, an entirely innate ability that some people have in great quantities and others seem to scarcely have any imagination at all. But generally speaking, I think most of us think of it as something that either you have it or you don't, like you're a blonde or you're a brunette. And of course,
I guess you can change that too.
Absolutely. Yeah, no kidding. But you really help us understand that imagination is a tool that can be fostered and nurtured just like anything else.
You bet. In fact, there are some interesting surprises in this. When I started digging into it, I realized, you know, most people think about that their imagination is something that you just sit around with your eyes closed under a tree and you're imaginative. Well, that's one way to do it. But really, most great ideas come from starting with a set of data. The more experiences you have in the world, the more you have to work with, because your imagination is essentially connecting, combining things that already are in your mind. This is why people who live in very enriched environments can have much more rich imagination than those who grew up in a very limited environment. And so the more engaged you are in the world and the more really active engagement, paying attention, listening better, watching better, you know, feeling things more deeply, the more you have to work with and the more you can envision what might be different. In fact, it's critically important to realize that our passions, our ideas about what could be, are designed after we're engaged. Before it's your passion, it's probably something you know nothing about. And this is really important, because you can do anything from waiting tables to taking a trip around the world, and those experiences are going to really light up opportunities.
Hmm. So one of the steps you lay out is the importance of moving from engaging in the world, with the world in a fashion that fosters our own curiosity, to this idea of then envisioning. And this is probably an important step that a lot of us don't fully appreciate.
Yes. As I just mentioned, right, you engage first and then you envision what might be different. You know, your passions and the things that you care about follow that engagement. I tell a number of stories in the book of people who are going about their lives in a very expected way, and then something happens to them that triggers their motivation to do something differently and to solve a problem. And that can happen to any of us. If we're actually paying attention, we start seeing places where we really can make a difference and address the challenges that are around us.
I appreciated how you help explain why this envisioning skill sometimes erodes over time. You write at one point, the ability to visualize is critically important for imagination. Unfortunately, as we get older, most of us aren't encouraged to practice this skill. Beyond childhood, we stop telling imaginative stories ourselves and focus instead on reading other people's fiction. We stop making artwork and begin looking at other people's creations. I guess one of the reasons this leapt out at me is because my full-time job happens to be teaching music in a college setting, and my wife is a music teacher. And it seems like there are a lot of forces at play in the world which are all about maybe the STEM areas of study, mm-hmm. and in particular also you know, business and management and so on, important areas of discipline of study, which can sometimes crowd out the arts. And you are writing here in a way which suggests that that there is a very important place for that kind of study, if for no other reason in just fostering your ability to be creative and imaginative in other arenas in your life.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I was at an art show last night. A friend of mine was displaying some artwork, and I went up to one of the paintings, and it said, you know, artist in the name of the artist. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Does that person define themselves as an artist? Does that mean that I'm not an artist? Right, I'm a musician, artist, writer. Well, I'm a writer. You know why I'm a writer? Because I write. You know, you're an artist if you actually pick up a paintbrush or, you know, some clay. You're a musician if I could, you know, bang some pots together and start making music. I mean, I don't know if you agree with me, but I feel as though by labeling people in this way, it means that the other people label themselves as not that. Right? I'm not an artist. I'm not a musician. I'm not a writer. But of course, we all have these skills. And I really am a huge believer that these are things we should be baking into our lives in all different ways. Yes, I might not be painting all the time, but to know that that's something I could do, you know, I could pick up a paintbrush and express myself that way. Why not?
Absolutely. And of course, it's only when you're given those opportunities and the invitation and the encouragement to do so that you might even discover creative outlets you didn't even know were there. And,
exactly.
And who knows the ways in which they might be applied, particularly when we get good at this thing called reframing, which you talk about a little later in the book. But one of the most important things that one can do in bringing about innovations and successfully bringing them to the world is not being stuck in the same framework of the present.
Yeah, I spend most of my time teaching. This is what I focus on, is how do you reframe problems? How do you look at a problem from very different angles to come up with really different solutions? I'll give you just a really simple example. Let's imagine we were a friend of ours was having a birthday, and we were going to brainstorm about a birthday party. Let's have a birthday party, and let's come up with ideas. If we change one word in that prompt from let's plan a birthday party to let's plan a birthday celebration, we've now opened up the frame of possibilities. The question you ask is the frame into which the answer will fall. So if you don't ask the question properly at the beginning, you're not going to get as rich a set of solutions.
Right.
And so by just thinking about looking at the problem you're trying to solve in really different ways, subtle to very bold new perspectives, you end up coming with really, really different different solutions.
One of my favorite moments in the book that speaks to that is where you had a various teams in one of your classes engaging in brainstorming, and one of the teams was supposed to rethink movie theaters, and they came up with all kinds of interesting ideas, including one in which maybe people, while they're watching a movie, would all be on stationary bicycles. I mean, getting their exercise while they watch this this 2-hour movie. I mean, what a fabulous idea! But if the framing of the question was such that the task was to take present-day movie theaters and do what they do just a little better or come out ahead of their competitors, that leaves you stuck in the original frame. But when the question is framed in such a way that you can envision an entirely different kind of movie theater.
Right.
I mean, it's just thrilling to think about the possibilities that, in a sense, are out there just waiting to be discovered or thought of.
Right. That was part of an exercise where I have the students unpack all the assumptions about something. So that was part of all the assumptions of a movie theater or the assumptions of a fast food restaurant or the assumptions about airline travel or hotels. You can pick whatever topic you want. You unpack all your assumptions, and then you turn them upside down. So one of the assumptions was, of course, that you're sitting there quietly, and they questioned that and said, gee, what if we ended up, you know, sort of combining a spin class with a movie theater, and you had sort of a spin class where you're watching a movie, and one of their ideas was you pay at the end, right? If you end up, the more exercise you do, the less you pay for the movie. So the idea is that you actually have an incentive, even a financial incentive, to get more exercise.
Hmm. Well, there's a whole lot more to be discovered in this wonderful book, which takes us all the way through this cycle, including all kinds of important insights on what it means to take this to that that stage then of entrepreneurship and of persisting through barriers to bring an innovative idea to full fruition. The book again is called Insight Out: Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. It's published by HarperCollins, and the author, Tina Selig. Professor Selig, this was a great pleasure for me to read your book and to speak with you about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Monday on The Morning Show, an important and timely conversation. We are scheduled to have a conversation with Richard Stein, Director of Law Enforcement Training here at Gateway Technical College, and Raymond Clark, one of the instructors in Gateway's Law Enforcement Academy, talking about how can we most effectively train those who go into the important work of law enforcement. On Tuesday, Loreen Carey, the author of a beautiful book called Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century, as Loreen Carey recounts what it was like to take this older relative, almost 100 years old, into her own home, and some of the interesting conversations they had about, among other things, race a lighthearted conversation next Wednesday with Brad Baluchian, author of The Wax Pack. The author, as a youngster, collected baseball cards. He decided as an adult to buy off of eBay one of those packs of Topps baseball cards, and then he sought out those baseball players who were part of those particular cards. A wonderful adventure. Next Thursday, tentatively scheduled, Kenosha's mayor, John Antaramian. And a week from today, we reconnect with Mark Cushman, one of the world's great experts on Star Trek, the original series. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock and is available as a podcast 7 days a week as The Morning Show with Greg Bird.